Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, back by popular demand, is sector strategist Denise Chisholm, looking specifically at how certain sectors have been performing and what sectors to watch in the global markets. Denise shares with host Pamela Ritchie that most of the leading indicators she sees are suggesting an increase in market volatility, but reminds us that corrections are normal and natural for the market. Denise notes that there has been a broadening out of the market after the gains over the last 3 years have been dominated by technology and consumer discretionary. Today, Denise also looks at income levels and savings rates, as well as inflation, taxes, and how a possible rising minimum wage in the U.S. could impact various sectors. This podcast was recorded on March 25th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Help us make sense just right now of the week that we're looking at right now. It is mostly risk off. We certainly have certain things falling out of bed. That said, you're going to tell us about some things with long runways. How do you sort of put this week into perspective?
Yeah, I think as we entered the year, it's certainly one of the things I've been talking about is while the backdrop for equities is constructive and a lot of the leading indicators I see, most of the leading indicators I see are also more suggestive of increase in volatility. So in some ways, this week is unsurprising based on where we came from. You should expect more volatility and it's somehow more at the stock level and potentially at the sector level than the overall index level. But even if you step back further and say we're about to see something more typical than standard volatility can be pretty intense as well. 60% of the years since 1962 have a peak to trough correction of somewhere between 5 and 15% during the year, and that's on month-end data. But 75% of those years are up for the S&P 500. So it just goes to show that corrections really are normal and natural and a healthy thing for the environment, for the market overall. And we're likely to see them at an increasing pace. So what's really important for investors is to stick to their overall investment philosophy and use those corrections as an ability to add to where you think market leadership may be over the next year.
Take us through a little bit of, I mean, we've seen huge upside just in this year. It's only March, for heaven's sakes. I mean, we've seen a lot of things booked already. Again, take us through, like, is there sort of more to go is really the question.
I get questions all the time in terms of, you know, since we're up so much off the bottom, do I have to trim? Shouldn't I just trim just mathematically because it's up so much and sort of take some profits and think about diversification into other areas? And when you look back in history, we only have a rare number of instances of between on month-end data being up 50%. We could get more granular, but I don't want to do that. On month-end data, we'll lap March and essentially be up 50% in the S&P, putting us in that zone where if you go back to the 1930s and you look on a go-forward basis, you actually have 75% hit rate in the Dow on a very few number of instances and a 56% hit rate in the S&P, again, on a few number of instances. But what this does tell you is that it's not sort of a knee-jerk reaction to say, oh, I need to trim. You know, as much as it's sort of in the back of your mind as an investor is that you made a lot of money and you might want to take some gains off the table, history doesn't say that yes, you should. So I think you want to be conscious of that fact historically is that being up this much is not necessarily a reason to sell.
And so how so? I mean, what further, I guess, do you see that can sort of solidify that for people?
Right. Let's talk about a little bit about the broadening out of the market, which I think you alluded to earlier. Certainly, you know, the gains over the last, let's call it 3 years, have been dominated by technology and to a lesser extent, consumer discretionary. I think some of the mixed bag that you highlighted that we're seeing year to date, where more sectors are actually outperforming, is a good thing and is a little bit of the canary in the coal mine to the differences we're seeing potentially this cycle versus the last cycle. And the last thing, we talked a little bit about inflation and sort of core CPI inflation and the sheer amount of income growth that we have seen potentially being different and generating more of that inflation. But we're also seeing some critical drivers for commodity inflation. And this is very different from what we saw over the last decade. Not only do we have an increasingly steepening yield curve that's reaching threshold levels that are predictive of commodities, but we're seeing government spending increase, not decrease. Remember, after the great financial crisis, we flipped very quick back into austerity after that sort of 2010, 2011 fiscal spend. So this is a very, very different situation. And that tends to be a driver of commodity prices.
And we all are going to, well, particularly in the U.S., but we've all had stimulus programs thrown at us in many of the developing world countries. So just going back to your point about income levels, I mean, where we sit with money sloshing around either in bank accounts, but, you know, it's there in a different way.
That's right. No, and it's very different. I mean, we've spent 8 months in top quartile income levels that we have not seen since the late 90s. But more importantly, it puts us in a completely different category that we saw in the 2010s, which is the consumer has more income relative to what they spend on either non-discretionary items like housing and debt service or specifically commodities. And this is important because this is the point where you see demand destruction. So meaning if we take crude and you say, you know, the consumer is price sensitive, they're price sensitive when it historically hits certain income level as a percentage of their income. Energy consumption as a percentage of income has been at lower and lower levels throughout history and now is near all-time low levels. So what you've seen is a shift in terms of demand destruction. It used to be during the 60s, 70s, 80s, the breakpoint for no mas from the consumer was around 6.5%. It did shift down to 5% in the last, let's call it 20 years. But if we say that that 5, and maybe it'll shift down again, but if we said that that 5 was the threshold level, given our starting point, you have a much longer runway than the last decade. Just to do some quick back of the envelope math, what you could end up seeing with income growth that's likely over the course of the year to just get to that 5% level would take $5 gasoline, which is essentially a double from some of the data that I'm looking at, which is not to say that we will get there, but I think you want to highlight the fact that there's just a longer runway than I think people are giving it credit for from a commodity inflation perspective.
It's interesting because when you look at some of the numbers that come in on Wednesdays have to do with whether there's a surplus or we've seen drawdowns or so on. And we've seen extra demand in diesel, for instance. I mean, there's and gasoline as well. There are interesting little pieces to the story that seem to be showing a different type of demand. I think that some had been expected. I mean, we are seeing a high oil price right now, which is falling right now. And there's lots of very visual reasons for that. But again, sort of commodities, that's the oil discussion of how that hits people's pocketbooks, broaden even the commodity story out for us.
Yeah, I think it's in some ways you could make the argument that all pricing, whether it be at consumer goods, whether it be at the commodity level, has a very different runway. If you think about when the consumer is most sensitive to price increases, it's when they don't have extra income to spend. It's when their income is tied up in debt service, like we talked about, housing, you know, food, gasoline. In the aughts and, you know, sort of up to, you know, 2016, the consumer, a large portion of their spending was really tied up in these non-discretionary buckets. So anytime you really, as a producer, tried to push through cost increases or pricing increases, the consumer was very sensitive to that pricing level and then destroyed demand. You have to recognize that on a go-forward basis, we're in the complete opposite position. Right. So consumers' non-discretionary income, non-discretionary spending is now at all-time low level relative to their income. So that discretionary bucket makes them a little bit more immune to those pricing increases. Look, it may not turn out much differently, but I think the backdrop is so different. As investors, we need to be conscious that this could be a much more long-lived commodity inflation trade than I think most investors are expecting.
And driven, as you say, driven in the past by China buying all kinds of commodities, needing that to create the bull market, as you say, right. Quite a different reason for it all.
I think that it's not going to be the reasons of certainly the aughts where, you know, China was the incremental buyer of 75% of all steel, copper. I mean, we remember the story. We're not going back to that story. This is a different story, though. And this story might end up in the same way or have the same result, but for a very, very different reason. And that's what I want people to understand.
Okay, so Denise, how does geography play into your process and sector outlook? And I guess, you know, just sort of going global on this front, how does that fit?
Sure, I think it's interesting. Again, it's not going to be sort of the coordinated global recovery exactly at the same time that many investors suspected, given that Europe is entering somewhat lockdowns and sort of delaying that cycle. I'm not sure that's necessarily a bad thing, because I'm not sure that if the globe all recovered at the same time in the same way, we would quite be able to handle the sort of wall of potential stimulus and demand at the same time. So I'm not necessarily certain that this is a bad thing, that it's being a little bit more drawn out. All of that said, the way I look at the data, the U.S. is still likely leadership. And I say that because the risk reward is still beneficial on margin expansion. And I think that the critical drivers are still in favor of the dollar. So I think that there's a big narrative about typical recovery plays are outside the U.S., specifically in emerging markets and specifically maybe IFA. When I look at the data, I don't come to very clear conclusions. It is at times leadership outside the United States in terms of recovery, but it's usually a coiled spring based on low levels of relative valuation and low levels of relative growth. That's not true right now in emerging markets or in broader international, that I would say Europe and Japan. So that situation has not really happened. And specifically in emerging markets, I think that there's a big negative secular story of lower to lower secular ROEs that I think investors need to at least be conscious of, which puts EM at the broadest level, which is not to say there's no opportunities, but at the broadest level, a potential value trap. So I think the U.S. is still dominant leadership, in part because of the rotation back to the dollar for reasons we've talked about. But I think that the more critical drivers are higher relative rates and higher relative growth that we're likely seeing. But I think that outside the U.S., we're not really teed up on those relative valuation and relative growth factors. So I think that that's a concern. If you told me I had to look across the globe and pick the best asset class as a risk reward, I'd actually pick U.S. small caps.
Well, and they're essentially correcting right now.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, that shows you my bias that I would lean into.
Very, very interesting. You mentioned, I just want to go back to margins, which you mentioned a couple of minutes ago. Just sort of give us a sense of, you know, that can be, there could be a crippling effect when we see pressure on margins. Do you sort of work that into how you're looking at things?
There's rumblings right now about that narrative. Oh, commodity inflation. And look, I mean, commodities are up significantly off the bottom. Is this going to be a problem for corporate profit margins? Is this going to cap the earnings growth in the S&P 500? It's really interesting and telling when you look back through history and you say, let's look at all the times when any input cost, give me any input cost, wages, the CRB, crude oil prices, all of the dominant input costs, not only when they're growing, but accelerating. So growing at an accelerating rate. Then tell me what my margins are over that year. If I knew all of those input costs were going to accelerate, they go up more often. 70% of the time they go up versus sort of 30 on the other side, which is, I think, interesting. So it shows you once again, when you look, remember not to hold all else equal from Econ 101 and take, well, given the sales, then we're going to hold those constant and then subtract out higher input costs and therefore we get lower earnings. Remember that there are more moving pieces in the market, and more often than not, sales accelerate faster than your input costs. So I think that the narrative that, you know, higher commodity prices are going to be a significant headwind to future margins and their future earnings growth in the S&P 500 may very well be overstated.
So interesting. Fascinating. Okay, so couldn't the, and this is sort of in quotes, green wave lead to increasing energy costs in the next few years? Do you think that consumers can continually afford rising costs on that front?
Yes, no, I think that that's a great question. I think that there's a fair amount of evidence that green, the transition to green energy is going to be more costly to the U.S. consumer. I think the good news is that energy consumption as a percent of disposable income, and I think this is global as well. I haven't done the global chart in a while, maybe a year, but it's the same thing, which is it's back to all-time lows. So the consumer has a potential to sort of spend in that area to the extent that A, they want to, and B, the product offerings are beneficial. So, and this is sort of the story, is that, again, recognize that runway might be longer than you actually think, that the consumers, because of their savings, because of the income growth they had, and because of the recovery that's likely to come, might not be as dissuaded as you think on the expense associated with whatever product it is they're buying, whether it be energy, green energy, old energy, or, you know, retail, you know, products as well.
It's so interesting. So, I mean, it makes you, because lots of people are worried about inflation right now. It's a big worry. Everyone's talking about it. But it does sound from some of the pieces that you're talking about, again, in different areas, not necessarily as an overall picture, but right, that we can afford it. I mean, is right, that?
I think basically that is the base case. I mean, there are two things. I mean, one, just as a consumer, is it going to be a problem for the consumer? And I'd say, again, that difference in runway. And then I'd say, like, there's a separate conversation, which is this going to be a problem for the market? And my answer to that is, I don't think so, in the sense that when I look at the historic data, I view people as sort of in two camps. One is that inflation won't happen, and that's a good thing because we can't tolerate it, or inflation is going to happen, and that's a bad thing for the market. And I actually am more in the middle of, I think inflation is happening, but I don't think it's going to be as problematic for the market as you might expect. This inflation cycle is quite different than anything we saw in history, because for the first time, we're really pricing out the risk of deflation. And deflation is just as corrosive to financial markets and the economy as inflation is. We can argue whether or not it's more corrosive, but we don't have to get into that. We'll just say it's equally a problem. And this is one of the first times where, I mean, really, in, what was it, 2013, 14, 15, CPI was fine. It was, you know, hanging out 2.5%. Inflation expectations were constantly eroding. And that was the market really saying, this, you might be fine now, but if we get hit with a shock, the tipping point to inflation is going to come very quickly. And now we're in the opposite category, where inflation expectations are rising faster than inflation. And that's historically, again, not long ago, been a pretty good thing for market multiples and for the market overall. And I think it shows you in the data that this pricing out of deflation risk is something that is real in the market. So yes, we are going to price in increasing risk of inflation, and inflation that's unwieldy, but it's also going to be balanced by that pricing out deflation that we just were sort of in the zone with.
Right. It's absolutely fascinating. The rising minimum wage is in the news, certainly. How could rising wage growth impact your sector outlook in the future, if at all? It goes to inflation. It goes to pricing power. How do you look at that?
Yeah, if you stand back, I mean, I think I put it in all the pricing power. And even regardless of the minimum wage, whether or not it gets passed, we're certainly seeing wage growth increasing. And even if you look at the NFIB survey, it's finally sort of tipping. And I'm actually going to talk about that, Pamela, in the charts of the week, just how much pressure there is to A, hire, and B, hire at a higher wage. And that is broad-based, regardless of sort of the minimum wage. And if you look back historically as a sector investor or as an investor, and you say, what does that mean historically? It means a continued push towards cyclicality, right? So wage growth in an accelerating picture means more economically sensitive sectors, like, let's call it energy, industrials, consumer discretionary, even technology, and to a lesser extent, financials, tend to outperform. And it's more those classically defensive sectors like consumer staples, utilities. I'm going to put real estate in there for now because it is defensive this cycle. And that big pharmaceutical portion of healthcare tends to underperform. So that's usually the balance. Now, look, that has been the game over the last 6 months, 9 months, depending on sort of which sector you're looking at. But we've seen that sort of tip back towards cyclicality. But that increase in wage growth suggests that despite the fact that cyclicals have outperformed, it's still likely to continue, albeit maybe at a slower rate, but still likely to continue.
a long runway. Let's talk about financials, which you put in there, and you said to a lesser extent financials, but you like financials. You think they have some very interesting share with us what it is you like about financials at this point.
Right. I do think the risk reward for financials is positive. And it's mainly because if you look back, I mean, financials investors have been stymied this whole last decade. If you look before the great financial crisis, you have pretty good odds, 70% odds of, you know, buying the banks or all the financials when they had improving ROEs, they had improving earnings growth, they had improving net interest margins. Those 70% odds went to 30% odds after the great financial crisis. The only thing that's really worked is getting relative multiples right, not even getting absolute multiples right. So it's really been this sort of pain trade where you've gotten sort of the earnings growth that you thought you would get, but it's been met with a wall of multiple compression. That wall of multiple compression on a secular basis, outside recessions, or I should say coming out of each recession has seen lower and lower relative multiples with lower and lower rates. So if we are truly in this dynamic of inflation is fundamentally different in the sense that inflation expectations and inflation are rising, then that is likely to lead to higher rates, maybe not markedly higher, but markedly not lower rates in the future. The expectation is financials could actually climb back up that curve and re-rate to higher levels just on multiples. And the big problem with financials historically is that they have this strong tendency to V-bottom. And those V-bottoms are always correlated to relative earnings growth, meaning that one of the best cycles in terms of relative performance was off that 2000 low or relative low for financials. But earnings growth was never something to speak of. And that's what's difficult for fundamental investors and what makes financials a potential pain trade and very different than other sectors when you look at it. So we could be sitting here in a year, 2 years, 3 years from now and say, well, you know, fundamentals were never really that good, but the stocks actually outperformed significantly just based on multiple expansion. So that's the backdrop that creates a really positive risk reward for financials. But that said, I always say, I think, you know, from a top three perspective, I am most interested in energy, industrials, and equal weighted consumer discretionary. But again, we go back to sort of the market broadening out and away from defense. Right. So I don't think it's a winner take all market like we saw in 2017, 18, 19, where it was really dominated by technology.
Create opportunities across the board, as you say, in all of these different sectors. What does market history say about the impact of rising corporate, also personal tax rates on earnings potential?
Right. In some ways, it's absolutely shocking. So if you look back to 1950, I think we have 24 instances, each individually, of corporate taxes going up, personal taxes going up, and capital gains taxes going up. And in each of those years, you have higher odds of advance and higher average returns than any baseline year. So that's strange, right? So you say you have this major headwind during the year. Clearly, stocks should have, you know, gone up less than historical average. When you really dig into market history, what you find is coincident with those tax increases, you had more spending, more government spending. So there was an offset. And even if earnings growth averaged a little lower during those years, the offset was with multiple expansion as the market looks through potentially a one-time tax increase. And we can talk about whether or not that that's true this time, but certainly historically it has been one time with the exception of the capital gains rate, which went up, I think, every year for 5 years in the 80s. But when you think about that, the multiple expands based on the fact that spending is stickier and stays around more constant. So I think with that as the backdrop, you have to look at what we're seeing as the potential for higher taxes is the potential for a significantly higher spending. So there could be a significant offset, and history would say you have to respect the fact that there was an offset. Does it create more volatility? Probably, especially with a backdrop like this, like we've talked about, coming from high levels of uncertainty, coming from low levels of earnings, all makes it a more volatile environment for equities. But I think that based on how I read the data historically, it doesn't say to me that you need to expect meaningfully lower levels in the S&P or in equities overall because of higher taxes.
It's interesting because it's a different type of stimulus in the system right now, probably. Well, I mean, some of it is the same as the great financial crisis, but there's a different type of mix in there right now.
Yes.
Does that mean anything for comparatives? I'm just mostly curious.
I think it is always meaningful at the idiosyncratic level, right? The further back you look at the data, the less meaningful it is. So yes, the CapEx is going to be a shift to green energy that we've never seen before, right? So that's going to be a different capital expenditure that's different from other cycles. You know, the checks that were written is very different from other cycles. On the high savings rate is very different from other cycles. But if you sort of lump it together, it's very, I shouldn't say it's similar to other cycles because it's about 8 times higher than other cycles. But I'm not sure that there's going to be meaningfully differences. It's going to be meaningfully different at the idiosyncratic stock level. But in terms of the cyclicality and non-cyclicality, I'm not so sure it's going to be, because I view that stuff as more or less a wash when I look historically at government spending.
Can you explain how you work with fund managers to support their mandates?
Oh, sure. I host a monthly meeting. I like to call it internal factorian, a debate where I present my views. And any portfolio manager, whether you're fundamental, whether you're quant, whether you're an analyst covering the consumer discretionary sector, can come and ask me questions and ask me for my interpretation of data on their sectors. So I do a lot of just presentations on Denise Chisholm's views, and then I do a lot of follow-ups on what significant investors, like if Ramona is interested in yield as a factor, I obviously do customized products for her on where yield is a factor, where the relative valuation is, what the economic backdrop is, what the critical drivers are, what the upside capture is relative to history, how this is different for you, and how you can use it in your fund. So I do factor analysis for some people. I do sector analysis for some people like Will Danoff. And I do sort of macro analysis for other people who just want to understand the backdrop of, have we gone too far too fast? So it's a lot of hats to wear, and I do a lot of customized analysis for a lot of people, but that's sort of what makes it fun.
That's absolutely fascinating. Okay, thoughts on the tech sector for the rest of this year?
Don't confuse high momentum stocks with technology. It's true that many high momentum stocks are technology stocks, but not all technology stocks are momentum stocks. So when you're given sort of two widgets to play with, value or growth, if those were your only widgets to play with, I think the risk reward is better in value. But I don't think you should accept just two widgets to play with as an investor. S&P technology is a very broad-based, diversified sector. And when I look at it, valuation is just back at median levels on free cash flow and earnings, with ROEs and operating margins at all time and increasing. That tends to be a pretty constructive setup. So potentially excluding a couple of non-earners that stocks are expensive, I think that there's a real opportunity in the diversified technology sector that is S&P 500, information technology, or pick whatever sort of index you would like, that there's still opportunity there. The question is, will that remain dominant leadership? And I think that there's better alpha opportunities elsewhere. Right. So energy, industrials, and to a lesser extent, consumer discretionary. But I wouldn't necessarily fund those buys with technology. I would think about funding those buys with more defensive sectors like consumer staples, utilities, real estate, et cetera.
Fantastic views for portfolio construction. Denise Chisholm, thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.